once more unto the breach, dear friends. Else close the wall up with our English dead. Good morning again, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls. And I said boys and girls. It may be that I'm over-hoping, but I'm going to keep hoping anyway. This is Jake McClure. This is the personal wealth coach. On the line with me, I'm younger Baldy. I have Elder Baldy. Elder Baldy, are you there, Jeff McClure?
I am. I think so.
Hello.
All I can see is your right ear, though. So are you there is the question.
I am here, and I'm going to tilt the camera a little bit. There we go.
Ah, there you are. You just appeared.
So those of you that are listening on the radio, please tilt your cameras around so that you can see us better as well. Well, yeah, I guess you can't. Sorry about that.
Well, we could do that one day, maybe.
Sure, we can do live streaming. I don't think anybody would want to look at us, though. We are definitely made for radio.
Absolutely.
Furry-faced, bald-headed, econ nerds. We're finance geeks, and we are the personal wealth coach. So hopefully we can help you understand what's going on in the world of finance today. But as all financial programs have to, for good reason, we're going to start with some disclosures. So, disclosure number one. This is not advice. What we're telling you is not advice. Even though the Personal Wealth Coach is the name of the radio program, and it's also the name of an investment advisory firm that acts as fiduciary. Investment advice has to be given in person, knowing a lot of stuff about you. And while we may know a lot of stuff about individuals in our audience, we don't know all of you. And so what we are going to do instead of advice today is give you education. Okay, disclosure number one, out of the way. You want to do the next one?
We do not pay for this radio program. Nor do we get paid to do the radio program. Rather, we pay for some advertisements for the radio program. Which doesn't make a lot of sense, but that's what we do.
Yeah, it's kind of... We consider it public service, but we do get business out of this. So we're going to come right out there and say it. It's not often. Usually people that have lots of millions of dollars don't call because they enjoyed a radio program. Although that's part of it. And the long-term relationship that you build with a radio personality may cause you to say, hey, these guys actually know what they're doing. So we do get some benefit out of this, but most of what we're doing is trying to educate. And you're using a different microphone today, and I can hear it really, really differently.
Is that better?
No, you're using the headset microphone. Moving that thing around won't help a bit. Why don't you put your headset microphone back down if you're going to be messing with it, because you are no longer hearable by us. There you go.
Obviously, I messed up.
Yeah. We can hear you. Don't mess with it while we're on the air. We'll get it out of break. All right, next disclosure. What do we got? The investment advisory firm that we were just talking about, the personal wealth coach, we're registered with the Securities and Exchange Commission. What does that mean? In order to be a fiduciary, and if you're above a certain size, any size, you need to register with a regulatory authority. And if you have less than $100 million under management, you register with the state. And if you have more, you register with the SEC. Well, the SEC, just because we registered with them, certainly they don't give us a thumbs up on anything. They don't approve anything that we say in advance. And the reason why we tell you who we're registered with is if you hear us say something obscenely wrong, those are the folks to complain to. I don't think we're going to say anything obscenely wrong. That's part of why we do this, but that's the point, is that you guys there needs to be some accountability. All right, any other, well, you're not going to be given disclosures right now, your headset's off.
Well, yeah, but I can still hear you and I can still talk.
Unauthorized personnel,
the information we present on this radio program, the information is educational. And it is from sources we deem to be reliable and accurate, but we make no warranty or guarantee as to the accuracy or completeness.
There you go. I was digging back through ancient letters from our office years ago, and you're quoting near verbatim a disclosure that you had at the bottom of your letters that you wrote yourself years ago. So as much as we claim it's legalese, you did it. How's that? All right, so what are we going to talk about today? Before we begin, you should know that your microphones... are you messing with your microphones while we're doing this?
Yeah, well, I'm back.
Oh, man, that's much better. Yeah.
It's just a matter of I had a brain cramp.
Oh, yeah. Well, I had an earlobe cramp the other day, so it'll be good. So what's happened this week?
Was there something happened this week?
I believe, depending on when you start counting the beginning of the week, that it started on either a Sunday or a Monday. Mm. And progressively throughout the week, the days changed from one to the next. And this is a headline grabber. Friday, we broke a major record. Do you know what it was?
Well, the S&P 500 broke a record on Friday.
Even bigger than that, because this is the first time we've ever broken that record, but this is a very clear record. This is Friday was the first time we have ever had an August 28th of 2020. I just thought that was important to throw out there because headlines are all about that.
I should have realized that right from the beginning.
Yeah. It's record breaking every day because it's the first time we've ever had today. So yeah, congratulations for breaking records, folks.
That produces plastic pollution.
Yes. But you had another record that is probably more in line with what we want to talk about today.
Well, the S&P 500 index for the week rose 3.6%, which doesn't sound like a big number.
So you multiply by 52. There's 52
and it becomes
months.
An absurd number.
Yeah, and that's not reasonable. We're not going to have that kind of growth this year.
The thing about it, it closed at 3508.01, for those of you who are interested in such things. Another record high. The other thing is, the last time I saw the S&P 500 closing like 3.6% up in a week to a record high was in the year 2000.
Yeah.
And history doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes, and it rhymes this, and 2020 rhymes very nicely with 2000.
Yes, it does. Even in the number rhyming game.
So, we have an interesting situation goes on. The market is setting at record highs. Meanwhile, the value side of the market, the S&P 500 Value Index, is down 11% year-to-date. It's only up about 3% for 12 months.
Let me step in just a second. What is value? What is the difference between people are talking about growth stocks and value stocks, and they just everybody assumes that you know already, and you just assume that they know because they're using the words? But let's talk about definitions. What is growth?
Growth stocks are those that are priced on what investors think the earnings will be a year or 2 years from now.
Okay.
And or maybe longer. I think investors don't think. I mean, when you have a stock that's trading at over 100 times its earnings, I don't think anybody is paying attention to what the earnings will be in the next 2 years.
I would even say it isn't a distinct time period. It's people are buying it with the expectation of growth in their profitability, growth in their earnings. So, doesn't have to be based in reality. But they have an expectation that the earnings will go up for some reason, either because they have a weird expectation that they pulled out of dreamland or because they really have analyzed the company and think that they have the potential to grow their earnings. Does that make sense?
There's two basic philosophies when it comes to stocks.
Mm-hmm.
One is they're like a rental house and says, okay, if you've got this much free cash flow at the end of the year, you've paid your debts, you've paid your taxes, you have depreciated the property because it's running downhill, and you've got a reserve set aside to take care of the next roof that you got to install and so on. And you got free cash flow after that. You look at that and say, that's the earnings. And you say, okay, so it's worth so many times, so many years holding the property before it pays for itself. And that's one way of looking at it, and it's a lot of people, including us, think that's a rational way of looking at a stock. The other one is It's going up. It's called momentum investing, and reduce, and its earnings are growing, and the stock's going up. Therefore, since it's going up, it'll keep going up, so we should buy some more.
Right. So back to what we were saying before, that's that keep growing up concept is pushing that growth in. So what is value? You were talking about the value index.
The value index is when you look at the earnings of a company and you look at the number of years you'd have to hold the stock for the earnings to pay for the stock that you purchased. You look at the underlying value of the assets of the company, everything out there, including its earnings, and you say that's a reasonable cost for that company. If I could buy the whole company, I would buy the whole company, and you buy the stock.
And really, when you're valuing a value company, you do it the way a bank would value your property. If you're going in and you say, I need a loan, the bank wants to know your net worth. They want to know what your free cash flow is, and they want to know what your debts and your assets are. And then they say, this is your net worth. Net worth is your assets minus your liabilities. And when a company is valued based on its free cash flow and its assets minus its liabilities, we call that a value company. So these are companies that you don't expect to double in price in the next 2 years. You don't expect that out of them because they're not trying to do that. They're trying to remain profitable, and they're trying to keep their debt level low and keep their assets valuable. So the difference between value and growth in the market right now, value is down for the year. Year to date, it's down. And you were just saying that, but now that the listeners have context, it's still up for a 12-month period by about 3%. But when you consider that the growth end of the market is up for a 12-month period, how much is it up in a 12-month period?
About 20%.
20% growth. And I'm going to give some examples of why we're calling this a little bit scary. I like Apple. I like Amazon. I like Facebook. I like Alphabet. These are companies that we all use. When I go online, I use Google when I'm looking for things. When I'm purchasing online, I usually use Amazon. Do I recommend buying them? No, I do not. And not as individual stocks. Because they're all being priced into the stratosphere based on remaining profitability rather than a lot of companies are in loss right now. In case you guys didn't know it, there's a pandemic on out there. So the companies that are remaining profitable, even though the profits may not be as high as they were, in the case of Apple, 2018 earnings were better than what's expected for 2020 earnings. 2019 was a drop in earnings. So 2018 had better earnings than what we're expecting during the pandemic year of 2020 for Apple, and yet Apple in the last 12 months has more than doubled. It went from 200 to 500. So we're not talking 20% growth there. We're talking about 150% growth. More than that. So if you just look at that for a moment and you go, why is that happening? Do they have any new products out? Well, they have an iteration of an existing product line. So why is their price up? Well, their price is up because they've been going up and people are crowding on board. They've averaged between a 15 and a 17 price to earnings ratio. That means their earnings for the company would pay for the price of their stock in 15 to 17 years. And it's now up in the 30 range, which doesn't make sense. Their earnings aren't up from 2018, and yet their price is more than doubled. And this is the very definition of irrational exuberance. At the same time that we have irrational, what's the other word, depression? Irrational pessimism on the value side of the market.
Well, I don't know. I wouldn't necessarily agree with that in this case. I think the value side of the market is fairly priced. I mean, the economy is down probably about 10 to 15%, and so is the value side of the market is down 11%.
Yeah, but I would say while the economy is down, This is an important factor. The GDP, is what how we generally measure the economy. It's like the profitability of the economy. And that's not exactly right because you've got tax revenue and spending and stuff in there. It's a little bit wonky. But generally speaking, it's pretty easy to say this is how profitable the United States is in any given year, is the GDP. The GDP is down. And when we say the economy is down, the GDP is down. What we were just saying about value companies is they're valued on their net worth. And the assets of those companies may be valued lower right now because the economy's down, but if you consider that the same assets in other markets are appreciated in value, if you question that, just look at your home value with interest rates being low like this. Your home value's up. Across almost the entirety of the United States, home values are up. And those are part of the assets, not homes, but in commercial real estate and a lot of these value companies. The underlying assets are up while the price of the company is down. That's why I say irrational pessimism, is that when you look at the net worth statements, the value has increased in many of these value companies, but the price of the company has gone down. And I realize we're getting into some semi-technical, jargony area, but I really like to say if somebody is being valued on their net worth and their net worth is up and you're saying your value is down, that seems like pessimism to me. Does that make sense to you? You could say it's fairly priced because the market's down, but
I don't know. There's an article in the Wall Street Journal that puts it very well. The median stock in the S&P 500, that means half the stocks are higher and half the stocks are lower, measured by forward price earnings ratio, in other words, what the company says we're going to earn next year,
right,
is now at the highest point it has ever been. It's in the 100th percentile. The only time we've ever seen anything like this was in 2000 and in 1929 before the stock market crashed.
Right.
And yet the value side of the market, I think it's reasonably priced considering the fact that we don't know for sure when the plague we're experiencing will be over. We don't know that it will be over. It's probably going to be over in a year. We don't know how much damage will happen by the time it is over. It's going to be something pretty serious, we can say that.
Yeah. There's been a lot of damage, and infrastructural damage, too. At the beginning of this, we were saying that this kind of natural disaster doesn't create a lot of infrastructure damage because it's not a hurricane or an earthquake. It doesn't destroy buildings. It is creating a different kind of infrastructure damage in that a lot of the smaller businesses that have closed simply will not reopen. And there's going to be a recovery period to that where new businesses will have to come in and fill those niches that were being filled by these other businesses. And that takes time. It takes a lot of time. If you've got a job and you've got the assets to start a business, it's difficult to do because you have a job and you have to give that up to go and start the business. So we've got some infrastructure repair work that isn't concrete and rebar. It's people. And that's not just from deaths. It's from business demand has slumped drastically, both due to mandatory lockdowns and due to just fear of getting sick.
We haven't finished the markets yet, but we have a question.
Oh.
Why is the Fed abandoning the Phillips curve?
All right.
Somebody who knows what they're talking about, obviously.
Yeah.
The Phillips curve worked for a long time, and it said that if unemployment goes down below a certain point, in other words, the more people who are employed, the more competition there is for those employees and the price of their wages goes up. Their wages go up, they spend more money. And so there's a direct relationship, according to the Phillips curve, between unemployment and inflation. So once unemployment hits record lows, you have inflation that followed. And it happened all through the 20th century with alarming regularity.
And Dr. Phillips, who is the Phillips in Phillips curve, said of all of the work that he'd done in his life, and he did a lot of work in finance, the Phillips curve was understood the least by everyone, including him, because he couldn't figure out all of the parameters we had too short a period of history to look at. I mean, we're talking about the 1970s. There's not a lot of global competition. The United States was it. When we were hitting full unemployment, people were making the same amount of product. They weren't getting more productive. And their wages were going up. And we put it into contracts across the country of, hey, you've been here for 5 years, you get this raise. You've been here for 7 years, you get this raise. And are you making more stuff? Well, that doesn't matter. The contract says you get a raise because you've been here long enough. And that led to inflation. So why is it the Phillips curve is not as important anymore?
Well, the problem is that we got record low unemployment in 2019,
mm-hmm.
and inflation dropped.
Yeah, we
inflation
did.
Was running down around 1%, which it's been doing for some years. And it actually, the studies that I read this last week went on for the last several years as the Fed has been looking at this exact issue. The problem is that if it gets too expensive to make something in the United States, you make it somewhere else.
Yeah.
So you can't raise wages. And because you can't raise wages, the amount of dollars out there that's floating around to buy things to cause prices to go up just isn't there. And the end result was that unemployment and wages and inflation separated and went their own separate ways. As a matter of fact, we were wrestling with disinflation or deflation on several occasions
right.
in the last few years.
Yeah.
So the Fed has finally said inflation is not, as a matter of fact, that's the thing we want to talk about today, and we will probably talk about it at length. The Federal Reserve has officially changed their policy. They're no longer going to anticipate inflation based on unemployment figures. They're going to wait for inflation to rise before they take action against it, which is exactly the opposite of what they've been over the last 40 years.
Right. And it's been a 40-year-long deal, and it's been effective. One of the things that needs to happen anytime you're talking to a scientist or an economist, not I would say that they're completely scientists, they're supposed to use the same methodology, is that when new circumstances arise, you have to change your perspective. You have to change how you measure things. And when we have a non-global supply chain in the 1970s, the prices were fixed in each country. And if you had inflation in that country, it was because of the manufacturing taking place in that country and then employment in that country. And with the world in the 1990s becoming more global and then in the early 2000 era becoming extremely global and getting more so over the last several decades, if someone said, hey, I want $20 an hour to make this washing machine, they just say, all right, we're going to make the washing machine in South Korea. Well, they did. Until South Korea, and this will be fun. We're going to get a little piece of trivia in here. In the year 2000, I was taking copious notes at conferences and trying to figure out a lot of stuff. And there was a consensus at that period that the term emerging markets, an emerging market is basically a country that's coming out of near Stone Age conditions and coming into the industrial age. It's not in the information age yet. It's in the industrial age. They go from working in with their hands or with a sometimes metal and sometimes not tool in a field or in a paddy to working in a factory making shoes. Well, the term that was used in the year 2000, again, I was looking at a lot of my old notes over the last week, was that if you had the per capita GDP of South Korea, so if you just divide a GDP by the number of citizens, or lower, you were considered an emerging market. So 20 years ago, South Korea was considered emerging. This is the source of K-pop and tech music and LG and Samsung, and this is not an emerging market anymore. Over the last five decades, over the last 50 years, we've gone from two-thirds of the world in what we would have considered third world at any other point, where they're basically slightly better than Stone Age, to one-third of the world being in that state. So that's a massive shift, huge shift. So 20 years ago, if you said, hey, I'm going to charge $20 an hour to work on this washing machine, that's how LG started itself. I mean, it didn't get started there, but that's when it really started to become profitable, is that the American workforce was charging too much money so they could sell really nice washers and dryers at lower prices, even though you had to ship them across the Pacific Ocean.
That's the other side of that.
Yeah.
The cost of shipping something across the Pacific Ocean has dropped phenomenally.
Transportation costs have dropped because of the big shipping containers. You can put a lot of stuff on a ship, and when you break down the cost of shipping based on how much stuff is on that ship, it's very low. It's extremely inexpensive. So this allowed
very few people on that ship.
Right, exactly. So it allowed the supply chain to stretch, not just the supply chain, but the supply source chain to stretch to places like South Korea and then into China. And China became the manufacturer for the world because they had a lot of cheap labor.
An example that people, I think, can relate to very quickly is flowers. I remember, and I'm old baldy, so I remember a long ways back. I remember when if you bought flowers for somebody, it was a really big deal because they were really expensive. It was like a day's wages to buy a dozen roses. So it was a big deal. And the reason was the flowers were generally grown in a greenhouse right behind the florist, and it took a lot of labor, and it was very inefficient, and they were, if you had them in the wintertime, that was really something big that was huge. They were very, very expensive in the wintertime. When you go to the grocery store, you can get fresh fruits and vegetables all winter long, and they're grown in South America and flown here.
Let's stick to flowers.
All right.
Do you know where 90% of the flower market is?
I think it's, you mean the source?
The source.
I think it's Colombia, isn't it?
No. It's the Netherlands. Did you know the Netherlands is the center of flower trade for the world and has been since the tulip bubble? They are the second largest producer of agricultural products in the world after the United States. They're the size of Connecticut.
They have wintertime.
Even in the wintertime. They have greenhouse complexes that cover huge areas, and they're very sophisticated greenhouses. They're not old school greenhouses. So they're producing vegetables now when they used to just produce flowers. So this is an important piece in that you can begin to see how industrialization is not the end of technology. Now that you're not an emerging market anymore, what are you? Well, South Korea is turning into an information age. The Netherlands is going information. We're going information. We're actually falling behind in a lot of the information capacity because our infrastructure build, our broadband was slow for a long time. This is one of the great benefits of the pandemic. And it's weird that I'm coming around as a benefit from the pandemic. The benefit from the pandemic is all the people that were stuck at home complaining about their internet connection actually got our bandwidth to be increased across the nation.
That's back to what you said about the Netherlands. I just want to say that's amazing.
It is amazing. It's one of those things. People don't talk about this. Why not? It's huge.
But I mean, because yeah, I would think it would be someplace in the tropics. And my information was dated probably 10 years ago.
Right.
10, 15, maybe 20 years ago, Colombia, Brazil, tropical nations where they never had winter were the number one flower producers. Now I see that I agree with you completely. Netherlands is the number one flower producing country in the world, and it's got and they're in Northern Europe.
Mm-hmm. And they're on
really cold in the wintertime.
They're on ground that they pulled out of the water.
That's just an astonishing thing that technology has caused flowers to grow in the wintertime in the Netherlands.
Right, on land that wasn't land, except that humans pulled it out, literally pulled it out of the ocean. Underneath the water, they pulled dirt up and sand up and made more land and built big walls that they have technologically created this marvel of dams and locks and levees that cover the Netherlands. And, you know, they've been working on this for centuries. But their technology on it is just amazing. It's phenomenal. They're creating many acres a day in the Netherlands. And it's quite all right because they're doing it on the mainland. And international law says, yep, that's still the Netherlands. When the Chinese do it in the middle of the ocean, on a shoal that may be belonging to someone else, now you get into weird areas. So this is, we're looking at the Netherlands for a lot of inspiration. And people go, well, the Netherlands? Well, that's how our system of free markets are derived as well. They came from the Netherlands. This is a tiny little country that took its own republic way before the democracy of the United States. They went to election. Now, they had nobles and they had a lot of other things in the process, but they fought their way out of German and Swiss and
Spanish
rules. At different times, they were run by the English tried to take over, and so they took over England instead. And you can look that up, guys. That actually did happen. The ruler of the Netherlands became the co-monarch of Great Britain. And it was just look up the Orange Revolution prior to the 20th century, and you'll understand what I'm talking about. And I'm not going to feel
boring.
Yeah. I'm not going to fill in too many of those details because I really do want people to dig into this. Why am I bringing up the Netherlands now? Because we're using them as an example of how to change our agricultural process ourselves. We are hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of times larger in landmass than the Netherlands. And we do produce more than them in agricultural goods. If you look by square footage, there is nobody even close, not even a little bit close to the Netherlands. If we had the same kind of agricultural product per square footage, there would be no world hunger. The prices of everything would be really, really low. Go ahead.
We have not given out our email addresses.
Let's do that. And that wasn't a complete answer to the Phillips curve question either. We went off on the edge because shipping is less expensive, and then I got geeked out on the Netherlands for a second.
Well, but that's the point. Things change. The Phillips curve worked as long as we had one nation, and that was our supply and demand, and everything was within the shores of one nation. But it changed. If flowers can be produced if Netherlands becomes the number one flower producer in the world, so in the wintertime when you buy roses, you're buying them from the Netherlands and don't know it, then the Phillips curve is out the window because the price of flowers can't go up because there's a near infinite supply of flowers.
Yeah.
Which is why the Phillips curve doesn't work anymore.
This is one of the amazing things about technological innovation, is that if we look at technology and the changes that it's done across the planet, we talk about two-thirds being in what we would consider emerging or very stunted technological to one-third. So two-thirds are now emerged. It's bringing up the quality of life and down the cost of living at the same time. So let's give out the email addresses, shall we?
All right, you can email us. The telephone line is being hogged by old Baldy here, so you'll have to email us if you want to raise a question or comment. And you can connect with us at either jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com.
Yes.
And I have a really good microphone so I can say TPWC very clearly.
Yes. We do have some commercials that we need to play, though.
Yeah, we have to do that too.
So we're going to play some commercials. We'll be back on the other side with more of the Personal Wealth Coach. Again, if you'd like to join the conversation, it's jeff@tpwc.com or jake@tpwc.com. And that's the Personal Wealth Coach or Tango Papa Whiskey Charlie. And we'll be back on the other side. And we're back with more of the Personal Wealth Coach, and hopefully we can do this real quick. Elder Baldy, are you there?
I think so.
All right. And I have to give a piece of humor in this process. The ad that was just played had Smokey the Bear in the background talking. was labeled Wildlife Prevention and Rising Ashes. It's not a very good headline for a... Let's have some wildlife prevention over here.
And rising ashes.
Oh.
All your bases are belong to us.
And we just had a crash of the system here, so... Yikes. Can you talk for a little bit while I try to go and find somebody?
Okay. Well, the rest of the markets were out there still rolling along besides the stock market. Chairman Powell from the Federal Reserve made some comments at Jackson Hole, and we're going to probably talk about those probably this week and next week and so on. It's because they're really big. But the yield on the 10-year U.S. Treasury notes soared over 15%, ending the week at 0.732%, which is still astonishingly low for the interest rates you get if you loan the government money for 10 years. In other words, if you buy a 10-year Treasury note, you're making a loan. Let's say you spent $10,000, you put it in a 10-year Treasury note, and you're going to get 0.732% per year. The 30-year Treasury bond, on the other hand, rose all the way to just over 1.5%. Again, if you buy a U.S. Treasury bond at this point and inflation does what the Federal Reserve wants to do and rises to 2%, you will earn a negative 0.5% for 30 years. That's still pretty astonishing, but it rose 15%, which indicates that the bond market has a little bit of optimism that it didn't have earlier. Short-term Treasury securities are running near zero out to about 2.5 years, which is probably about as long as interest rates are going to remain at zero because things are going to be rough in the economy. So that's about the way it's going to work. West Texas Intermediate crude rose 1.78% to $42.99, which sounds really good compared with the negative $37 it was a few months ago. But it's still down 30% year to date. And all these indicators in the bond market and the oil market are saying one thing. They're saying it very consistently. Demand is way down. The economy is running a lot slower than it was running a year ago. It's running a lot slower than it was at the beginning of the year. All those indicators tell us, number one, that things are slow. Number two, they're going to stay slow for probably at least another year. And the bond market is saying it's going to be more like 2 years out from now, maybe 2.5 years, before we start seeing a serious recovery in the economy.
Yeah.
Are you back?
I'm back. I wasn't able to find anybody in here, so we'll just have to see. Hopefully the news will play at the right time. We'll see.
Oh, that's good.
You never can tell these days, because technological innovation happens, and with it becomes the technology. So we're so excited about all this innovation and so on, but sometimes it's not very innovative.
You said that it crashed. I didn't hear anything, though.
No, well, it wasn't the old school crashing, which you have a story on that subject. I just got a window that popped up and says the command you've issued, which I didn't know I was issuing any commands. I didn't even click anything. It said requires too much memory and will not be completed. And then it disappeared.
I've had that problem.
Yeah, I'm going to have to start telling people that. When they ask me to do something, I'm going to tell them, the command you have issued requires too much memory. It will not be accomplished. It's a great error.
Somebody starts reeling off a series of things that I need to do, and I said, the command you've issued requires too much memory and will not be accomplished.
There's an acronym that's used online quite a lot, TLDR, which is too long, didn't read. And that they could have just put that as the error.
The EULA was TLDR.
Yes, EULA TLDR.
If you understand that, you're really into understanding digital stuff.
Yeah.
Well, there's other things going on this week besides Chairman Powell's comments, which probably we could spend an entire radio program talking about. We may do it next week. Who knows?
Yeah.
But the Commerce Department announced that consumer spending, which drives about two-thirds of our economy, rose 1.9% in July, which sounds really good until you look back at the previous 2 months when it rose 8.6 and 6.2. And that looks really good, all that together, but it still is down 5% from where it was a year ago. And you got to understand that in order to keep up with inflation and keep up with wages and keep up with everything that's going on, consumer spending probably should be, in a normal circumstance, up 5% from where it was a year ago.
Right.
In fact, it's down 5%, which further tells us that the economy is running about 10% below its normal speed.
Well, and that makes total sense. We've got a 10% unemployment right now, and this is employment across a spectrum of different jobs. It's targeted on a group of people that does a lot of near 100% spending of their income. What am I talking about that? When we talk about stimulus, government stimulus, and that sort of thing, going back for many, many decades, there's a concept involved here that the people that spend the most of their stimulus check are at the low end of the economic spectrum. If they don't have money, it has a much larger impact on the economy than when rich people are given less money in a given year, because they usually have a lot of savings, and they'll just kind of keep spending through that. And they may lower the spending a little bit, but if you have some money to spend, you can keep spending. If you don't, you just don't spend. That's a total cessation of spending, and that we're seeing
Wait
that
a minute.
In consumer
Wait
spending.
A minute. That doesn't work.
What doesn't work?
If you don't have money to spend, you use your credit cards.
Oh, yeah.
Except that people aren't using their credit cards.
No.
They're paying off debts.
They're paying off debts hand over fist. And this is another interesting and fascinating part of the economy. Get this. Every dollar you spend on paying off a credit card debt is a dollar you're not spending somewhere else.
Oh, wow.
There's a mind bender. So it slows down spending in the economy. It's better for your financial health, but it's an economic slowdown. So this is where micro and macro econ come head to head, where doing something that's good for you individually slows down the economy as a whole. I'm okay with that, because the lower we get our credit card debt, the better we have our savings, the more we're able to spend the next time we have high unemployment, the next time we have some kind of horrible disaster. Go ahead.
Speaking of the world's economy's debt, in other words, the combined national debts of all the world's economies,
mm-hmm.
is the highest it's been since World War II.
Right. So at the same time that personal debt is going down in the United States, governmental debt is going up in the United States, and there's a direct relationship. Much of the stimulus that came from the U.S. Congress from borrowed money is being used now to pay off credit cards, borrowed money. So we've refinanced a bunch of credit cards at the governmental level.
One of the good pieces of this, and you know, the debt, the national debt, is something that we used to worry people quite a lot. They don't pay much attention to it anymore.
Still worries me.
Well, the nice thing about it is the interest rates across all the way out to 30 years are lower than probable inflation will be over the next 30 years.
Yeah, if I were the government, I'd be refinancing everything on the books at this lower rate.
The government is running out to longer debt security maturities, which is a good thing for the government. In essence, right now, if you buy a treasury security, if you buy a treasury money market fund, you're paying the government to loan them money. Because the interest rate on the securities that you buy from the government, you're loaning money to the government, is lower than inflation. Inflation's running about 1.7% right now. And some things are getting cheaper, but most things are getting more expensive. And yet, there's nowhere on the yield curve that the interest rates are 1.7%. And you have to pay taxes then on top of that on the interest you get.
Right.
So the government is actually borrowing money at negative rates right now, which means they can borrow a lot of money and we'll pay them for it. The fear, and I think it's a legitimate fear, is that at some point, interest rates will rise. And if they do, and the government is rolling over its debt in short-term increments, which it is right now, that could be really bad, because if interest rates rise above inflation, which historically they have been, then all of a sudden the expense of paying for the interest on the national debt becomes absolutely huge. The smartest thing the government could do right now is borrow as much as it could at about 30-year maturities.
And then stop borrowing money for a long, long time.
Well, the point is that they're not. They're borrowing money at very, very, very short
right.
maturity, because that's a decision of the administration. which means it's going to roll over in some future administration to a higher interest rate. So, oh well. But if I were in the government, I like you, it's like I just refinanced. I'm in the process of refinancing our house.
Yeah, I close on Thursday on my refi.
And I had a choice of going 15 years or 30, and I went with the 30 because, goodness gracious, a 2.375% interest. That's a deal.
Now, we have to tell everybody out there that that's because it's a VA loan. That's not the average rate that people are going to be paying. In fact, on Friday, the average rate from Bankrate was for a 30-year fixed, which means you have to qualify for it. And there's some weirdness in that area. Was 3.14%. So, and that's a good credit.
I caught it at a really good point, and we locked it in. But
and you're a VA, which means that you have put your blood on places that that other people that aren't veterans haven't.
Yep, I did that.
And you actually get to be given some benefit for that, and you deserve it. I think that's one of the good things that we still do for our veterans.
Well, there's some other good news in the economy. The durable goods orders jumped 11.2% in July after rising 7.7% in June. Now, let's put some qualifications in there. First, let's just define what a durable good is. A durable good is something that you're going to keep for a while. Airplanes are durable goods. Tanks are durable goods. 18-wheeler trucks are durable goods. Washing machines are durable goods.
I've got a really easy one to say. If it was made in China, it was probably not a durable good. Still, they haven't gotten into durable good manufacturing.
But if it's made in South Korea, it probably was.
Right. If you got a refrigerator or a washing machine or a dryer, those are called durable goods because they last a long time.
The problem with that 11.2% jump, which looks really impressive, is that if you took out the fence...
Wait, and the who's one taking out the fence? I just put that fence in there.
Well, this is defense? If you take out the Defense Department orders, which were really, really large in July. And then you take out the one-time probable surge in 18-wheelers orders, trucks, transportation. Why is it a one-time surge? Because they just simply can't. They know in the world we're going to need. There wouldn't be enough highway to hold all the trucks if they kept doing that.
Right, and it's a one-time surge right now for some reasons that are in the news. It's getting harder to transport things through the U.S. Postal Service.
Yeah.
Amazon is doing a completely side business in transportation. They purchase a huge amount of trucks, and they're not the only ones doing it. UPS and FedEx are buying trucks. Walmart's buying trucks. You just go down the list of everybody that's still shipping stuff that have been using U.S. Postal Service and have moved away from it. Well, there you go.
The problem with this, with looking at that 11.2% number and said, okay, it's all over, the recovery's coming, we don't have anything to worry about, is if you pull out the one-time events that are not likely to repeat, it drops to 2.4%. So we saw a rise in durable goods orders of about 2.4%, which is pretty close to the 1.9% consumer spending rise we saw. And it, just like the consumer spending rise, it's still a 5% below where the total is still 5% below where it was a year ago, despite the fact we saw an 11% jump. In other words, there's a lot of suggestion in the numbers right now that August numbers are not going to be as pleasant. Probably we may actually see decreases in August.
Yeah.
And we're already running below where we were a year ago, and very, very likely we'll see a downturn in August.
What I can tell you right now, though, there are some deals out there on cars. The dealerships are losing inventory, but the prices are not going up with that because they're selling so slowly. People aren't buying cars at a fantastic rate right now because there's a lot less driving going on. You can go down and pretty well negotiate that price right down because the dealerships are paying an interest rate on the value of the cars on their lots. That's how that works. They have a line of credit, usually from the manufacturer, that says that they have those cars on the lot. This is why when they've been there a while, they have these big sales, only they're not having the big sales now. They're just everything is on sale. So there are some things you can do right now. We were talking about part of the market is low. And that's the side of the market that historically has recovered very well coming out of recessions. We've got prices that are extremely low on automobiles. I would not buy a boat right now. Boat sales are at record levels. What's that?
But there's nothing to pull them with.
Well, you just take them down to the water and then pull what car you have through the water. That's so boat sales are going crazy, and I think waiting till December of 2021 and looking on Craigslist for a boat, if you want a boat, because a lot of people don't know the work that goes into a boat, and so give it 2 summers to say, hey, this is great, but then 2 winters to say, hey, this really isn't great, and start looking in December for a boat on Craigslist for 2021, and you probably get a good deal.
I think that's probably a very good idea. People are anywhere in the economy that people can do recreation without associating with other people's families or other people outside of their family is doing very, very well. And we're almost out of time.
Yeah. If you would like...
For this hour.
Yeah, for this hour. We got another hour coming up after, and we might actually not have news. We'll find out. If you would like to talk to us off the air, we have voicemail waiting during the weekends, real live people during the week locally at
254-947-1111.
You can reach that same line toll free at 1-800-914-7526. That's 800-914-PLAN. You can go to our webpage, thepersonalwealthcoach.com or tpwc.com, where you can read our philosophy, see our clearly made for radio faces, listen to radio recordings going back lots of years, newsletter back lots of years. You can sign up there. You can contact us there or through Jeff at tpwc.com or Jake at tpwc.com.